Good morning. So last time we talked a bit about the formal definition of Big O some more and went through some examples of using that to prove that things were or were not Big O, and then the same principles would apply if you were proving things were and were not Big Omega and therefore Big Theta, which is a combination of the two. And our essential strategy was that we would, if we were proving that something was in Big O, choose some big C and N0, just big enough that the property would definitely hold, that this inequality would hold. If we were going backwards, we'd play this game where someone would give us a C and N0 with which they said would make this hold, and we'd show that they were wrong. We also talked a bit about some other classes. So Big O is kind of like less than or equal, and there's something which is more like strictly less than called little o. I was a little imprecise when I talked about it last time. So an important part of this is that it used the same formula with a less than instead of a less than or equal, but to make this work, you need to make this sure this is true for all C. Otherwise, you can just choose a bigger C and it's the same as Big O most, for the most part. We want it to actually be a strict bound. And similarly, we have little omega, which is like strictly greater than, instead of greater than or equal, which is what big omega is, and has the same idea, where we have a strict inequality, and we should have it work for when n is big enough for all c. We also mentioned the limit definition, where we take the ratio, and this turns out to be equivalent. So when the normal limit exists, we just take the limit as n goes to infinity of f of n over g of n and look at whether it's zero or infinity or something in between. And that tells us which of these three classes we get in. When we have to worry about a function like the nasty case I showed you last time, where like the function was either one or n squared, we might need to worry about fluctuation, so we'll have to take care of the details of whether we want the limit of the upper bound, which is the limit superior, or the limit of the lower bound, which is limit infinitum. But for the most part, if the limit exists, you just look at the limit, the value, and whether it's zero or infinity tells you what you need to know. So, any questions about any of this stuff before we move on to some other, perhaps more practical topics on Big O? Okay. So we've seen examples of using proofs to show that things are in Big O. We've looked at what these complexity classes mean from a sort of less than greater than perspective. In practice, we're not going to spend lots of time proving things. We're going to more rely on that sort of intuition that, yeah, n cubed is bigger than n squared. So, start that. Let's just go through some things you could prove, but we're just going to, mostly rely on just knowing that these things are the case. So one thing is that any sort of polynomial is smaller than any sort of exponential. And here I have sort of the most general case of exponential, which is that we have some base, often it's 2, because we're like taking, if we have 100 things and we want all combinations of those things, that's 2 to the 100 possibilities. So usually, naturally, you get 2 to the something. But this is the more general case where for some reason we have not just on or off, but on or off or in between. So it might be 3 to the something, or it would be like 1.5 to the something. Those are all behave kind of similarly, though they aren't actually the same complexity class. But all of them, all those exponential-like functions, are smaller than any polynomial function, even if you make k a really big constant. Similarly, we sometimes have factors of log n. This most commonly occurs when we're doing something that kind of looks like a binary search tree, that these naturally sort of divide our space in half, and that gets us this log factor. And anything time we take a polynomial and add an extra log n factor, that's a little bit bigger. Also, since we'll end up having these log factors a lot, you might worry about, well, what base is that log in? You didn't write a base there. Do you really mean base 10? That doesn't come up very often in computer science, and indeed it doesn't, but it doesn't matter. It turns out all the log bases are the same as far as big O notation is concerned. They're asymptotically the same. I'll show you why that happens in a second. Another important property is when we're dealing with polynomials, only the degree of the polynomial matters for big O. We can ignore the smaller powers. So, any questions on any of these properties? Yes?
I have a question, but it's not on these properties.
Okay.
Do we have an exam on Wednesday?
Do you have an exam on Wednesday? No, you have an exam on Tuesday.
During lab?
Yes.
Okay.
It's on the schedule. It has been.
So
the question is, what are the topics on the exam that's tomorrow? Anything that's been covered up to and including today could be on the exam.
Like, I did the practice exam, right? And okay, first of all, some of the things were clearly different from last semester, but some of the things like, what's it called, IEEE 754, do we need to know exactly what that is, or do we need to know how to deal with floating point numbers?
So the question is, there are questions on IEEE 754,
right.
Do you need to know what that is? Well, it's floating point, IEEE floating point. And you need to know about IEEE floating point. Like,
what size is that one?
So IEEE 754, the question is what size is it, is the standard for all the sizes. So presumably the question would have told you which size. They were talking about like single precision or double precision.
Okay.
Yes.
Will you be given
you be given the bias? No, you will not. Okay, so apparently I missed talking about the midterm. So yes, there's a midterm tomorrow. It's on the schedule. It's during lab. You should be going to lab anyway, so you'll be there. Okay. So other questions on either midterm coverage or asymptotic relationships. Okay, so I showed you this formula here, so let me show you the proof of that. Yeah.
I'm sorry. So is lab 5 not this week?
It is not.
Okay, cool. I may have already done it for lab.
Probably showed up and that might be harder to submit than usual.
Well, I didn't submit it yet.
Okay. So the logs. So you can prove this by you have log base k of n, that's log base l of n over log base l of k, and this is, and if you take 1 over log base l of k, that's just a constant c. And so it's exactly big theta, they're big theta of each other, they're the same big theta class, exactly. So those are some properties. So let's talk about some names. So often we won't say that something is, you know, big theta of n squared. We'll instead say it's quadratic. So let's go through a partial list of names for common things. So one common class is that we say something is big theta of 1. That means we would say that's constant time. And what this means intuitively is that it doesn't matter how big our input is, it just takes a fixed amount of time. You can, not necessarily the same amount of time for every input, but there's some maximum and it never ever gets bigger than that. And a classic example is that usually we assume that if we have a k as our input, reading the kth element of an array takes constant time. It doesn't matter how big k is, it takes the same amount of time. What? We also have logarithmic time, which is big theta of log n, and as I said, it doesn't matter what base the log has, so we'll just usually write without a base. And a classic example is that if I have a sorted array, doing a binary search on it is login. You might also say, well, aren't binary search trees data of login? We need a few more details to actually show when that's true and when it isn't. And we'll talk about that over the next few classes. So we also have theta of n, or linear time. And a classic example for this is if I have an unsorted array, searching on it is linear time. This is a case where it comes up that we're worrying about worst cases. We could find the element we're looking for right away, but that's not the function we're looking at. We're looking at what's the worst possible thing that could happen, and the worst possible thing is that it's either not in the array or it's the last thing we look at. With an unsorted array, that's always possible. And that's what we're going to use to determine the complexity. So then we have another common class, which is perhaps a bit less well known, theta of n log n, which I will often call log linear. So this comes up naturally, most notably in sorting an array by comparing elements. So the optimal ways of doing that have this time complexity. Some less optimal ways of doing that might be in our next class, which is quadratic. But if you do sorting by comparing optimally, you do theta of n log n comparisons and other operations like swapping array elements. So then we have quadratic. So this is theta of n squared. And the way to think about this is some reason I need to do something for every pair of items. So a classic example is if I want to find duplicates in an array, and I'm going to not do something perhaps a little more efficient, like sorting the array and then checking, I'm just going to compare every two elements in the array, that's going to be theta of n squared. Then we have cubic. This comes up occasionally, believe it or not. This is where we're doing something you can think of for every triple of elements in an array, for example. It would be the easiest way for this to come. And then we have our exponential case. So I have theta of 2 to the n listed and also c to the n. I write c because technically, like 3 to the n and 2 to the n aren't the same complexity class. So the classic example where this comes up is like I want to find the optimal set of things from like 20 things. So the way I do it is I check every possible set of inclusions and find look for the best one. There's 2 to the n of those because every item can either be on or off. And you can sort of see visually that these functions have markedly different growth rates for the most part. We have our 2 to the n, which starts by growing slower than n cubed, it looks like, but when we look at a zoomed out graph, it won't look that way. And as I said, when we started this topic, what we care about is the behavior way out there. And we have our n squared, which grows markedly slower. We have our n log n and our n. And these seem pretty separated at this point. Though often people will intuitively say that that log n factor is small. And we'll see that, well, in some scales it's small. But when we're looking at this sort of micro scale, it's not. And so when we looked at a more zoomed out version, we start seeing the hint that these lines are going to cross. And we start seeing that our n log n and n seem to be growing at a similar rate, but definitely actually significantly different. So we zoom out, we get to our final picture. And sort of something that we often think intuitively is that when we have these factors of like n or log n or n log n, these are really small, really not significant, and everything else is really big. And that's usually the intuition we have about runtimes. Whether this is actually true for your problem depends how big n gets. If you're in the sort of world where your n only gets to 100, then things are different. But when we're in the world where we're worrying about like thousands or tens of thousands of things, which is usually where we start out, you usually get into this intuition that, well, there's a big difference between n and n squared. Anything smaller than n or n log n is probably pretty fine. Like at this scale, we basically don't care. There is a difference between n and n log n, but we basically don't care. Yes?
In the graph, like, what does each axis represent?
So what does each axis represent is the question. So the x-axis is n. The y-axis is the value of the function, f of n, the vertical axis. And another way we might commonly visualize these things, because they have this drastically different magnitude, is with a log scale graph. So this is a log scale on our vertical axis, f of n, where the differences in magnitude are much clearer. But the key thing to remember is that when we're talking about these different complexity classes, usually we mean there's a huge difference. Intuitively, you can think of log n, adding a log n factor. It's a different complexity class, but usually it's not a very huge difference in the big scale of things. Now, this is sort of an intuition, and we had properties relating these functions. But what we actually want to do is we want to look at sort of a description of an algorithm and figure out, well, what complexity class is it in? And we like to do that in a way which is a little more formal than matching it to prior examples we've seen. So let's start with some rules of thumb, where the notion is you can look at pseudocode and figure out what does this mean. So one simple rule of thumb is that when we have a loop, we just look at how many times does the loop execute and multiply that together. We don't care about little things like, well, we're incrementing I in this loop. I don't have to add a term for that because that's going to disappear with the loop work. It's a constant factor of extra work. Yes, it's going to take time to increment I, but relative to the work of the loop, it's not going to matter as far as big theta is concerned. So for our first example here, we have foo. We're doing it n times, so it's big theta of n times the runtime of foo. It's actually, you know, n times the runtime of foo plus the time to increment I and set I to zero and all that. But that extra time for the loop ends up not appearing when we get rid of constant factors. Yes?
Oh, what happens if we have, like, instead of plus plus I, we have like, I plus three.
The question is, what happens if we did something, if we, instead of doing plus plus I, we did I plus equals three? So anyone can tell me, do we have a different big theta for that? Any, so people are shaking their head, want to explain why you think not?
Sure, that would be equivalent of n over 3, which is just another constant.
Yeah, so if we did I plus equals 3, this would be the same as a loop which went did j equals 0 to j less than n over 3, and then we did, in the loop, we did I equals j times 3, for example, something like that. So it would be n over 3 times the runtime of foo, which is 1/3 of this, but that 1/3 is a constant factor, which doesn't matter for big theta. If we did something like I times equals 2, that would be very different, because we'd actually be doing not a constant factor less iterations, but we'd be doing like a log number of iteration, log of n iterations of the loop. So what you want to look at in general when you have some sort of complex loop logic is how many iterations are actually happening. And all you need to care about is it n times a constant or not? And here, so I plus equals 3, that's n times a constant, or it's like less than n times a constant and greater than n times a constant. So it's the same for big theta. If you have something like I times equals 2, well, that's not n times a constant iterations. Like, you can't say 1/10 of n, that doesn't always work. Something more complicated is going on. Okay. So another notable rule is that when we have nested loops, we can just apply this sort of rule recursively, that we have n iterations of this inner loop here, and each that inner loop has a big theta of m times the runtime of bar. So we just put those together to get our big theta. And down here, I have this scary example. So here, we have j less than or equal to I. So we have a variable number of iterations in our innermost loop. And there are a bunch of ways of solving this. So one thing you could do is you could say, well, I remember my sequences, so I'm just going to figure out exactly what that is, because I have, you know, n times n plus 1 over 2 memorized, and I'm just going to do that. That's perfectly fine. Maybe you don't have that memorized, or maybe you don't want to figure it out and make sure you have it correct. So you can do some other bounding logic, which is simpler and often works in problems like this. So here, one thing we can say is that at least n over 2 of the time, we're going to do at least n over 2 iterations. We think of the last half of the loop over I, each of that time we're going to do n over 2 calls to foo. We're going to do more than that. So we have at least n squared over 4 calls to foo in that loop. So that's a lower bound. Just by saying the last half of the loop over I, we do at least half of the possible loop over j. And we could also say, well, we're doing less work than if we just change this j less than I to j less than n. So we're doing at most n squared, n times n calls to foo. So we have a lower bound, which is n squared over 4, and an upper bound, which is n squared. So we just know that the total number of calls is between 1/4 n squared and n squared, so it's theta of n squared calls. So as far as asymptotically, we can just say this is theta of n squared times however long foo takes to run. And you can generally use this kind of reasoning where you look at a loop where you don't know exactly what's happening, you just say, let's get a lower and upper bound, and that will tell us about the asymptotic complexity, because usually you'll end up with a bound like this, where you know, well, I don't know exactly the number of iterations, but I know it's, in this case, quadratic. Or you might find out, I know it's linear. Like, I don't know whether it's n or 1/2 n or 1/4 n, but I know it's between the two, so it's a linear number. And since we don't care about constant factors, that constant factor goes away. So any questions about that procedure here? How you would... So how you prove cases like this without actually doing your calculus work of, or your inductive proof work of figuring out what that sum is. Okay, so another common case the go is that you'll have two things right next to each other. This is just, we take the runtime is the runtime of them added together. And if you remember our rules for big O, big theta, is that because this is a lower bound, you just care about the bigger one, the one that's bigger asymptotically. Like if one of these is n squared and one of these is n, the n term disappears. It's just n squared. So another common case is we have an if statement. So we have if something, then foo, else bar. And here we're gonna make a use of an assumption I talked about much earlier that you may have forgotten, which is about the worst case. So we only care about the worst case, and that means that we're not gonna actually try to measure how often foo or bar happen, typically. So we're going to say, well, we need to run Qux because we need to actually do this comparison. And we need to, and let's assume that Qux has the worst possible result for us. So we do whatever of foo and bar takes the longest. So we're going to take the maximum of Feuerbach. And it could be the case that there are some like pathological problems where you can come up with cases where you like almost never call foo or almost never call bar. And in fact, almost never is enough that it doesn't matter asymptotically. But typically when we're doing an analysis, we're not going to run into those or care about them. And certainly for getting an upper bound, it's enough to assume that that doesn't happen. And if it's just dependent on the input, we definitely want to take the worst one. Because we could construct an input of the appropriate length which does the worst thing. So any questions about either of these cases? So for the most part, this lets you figure out what happens in any sort of pseudocode algorithm. Probably the only remaining tricky case is dealing with like recursion, which is just that you have something akin to what we did here, but with a function call. So you get some sort of relationship with something calling itself, but you can still solve that using the same sort of strategy. You just say, what's the runtime with n over 4 or something like that, and try to substitute that in, and hopefully you get an answer which is not infinity. Okay, so we've looked at a whole bunch of these rules of thumb, and this is how we'll be actually doing this in practice when you want to make a guess as to exactly what happens. So let's talk about specific examples of each of these complexity classes. So I mentioned constant time. And the way to think about this is that the litmus test is the runtime doesn't depend on the input. It can be really, really slow, but it doesn't matter what the input is. It's the same amount of slowness. As I said, this is just bounded by a maximum. So it doesn't have to be actually constant. It just needs to be that there's some maximum runtime and it's never slower than that, no matter what your input is. So asymptotically, it doesn't depend on the input, even if perhaps in the micro level, when we're looking at the beginning of that graph, it does. So classic examples is accessing an array element. We usually assume if we have an array of even a billion elements, that if we want the millionth one, that takes us constant time. We just say, give us the millionth element, we compute a memory address, we go there, and we generally assume that accessing memory takes the same amount of time no matter where we're going. You might complain, can this really be true? And you'd be right, maybe it can't, but this is the assumption we're gonna make for this sort of analysis. Another example is that if we're inserting and deleting from a linked list at an end of the linked list where we already have a pointer to it. So in that case, we don't need to traverse n elements, we just look at our pointer and use it. Doesn't matter what's going on in the rest of the linked list, even though that's conceptually part of the input to our insert or delete function. We just don't look at it. Another example, which is similar, is getting a vector size. We usually think of when we're implementing something like a vector, we just store the size. So getting the size is just copying that value. We don't actually look at all the elements. We don't need to iterate through and count them like we would with a linked list where we just have a head and a tail. So it's worth taking this time to note about some assumptions we're making. So I tell getting a vector size, that's constant time, because the vector stores its size. But if you think about this really hard, you might complain, well, we have to worry about really, really big n. This is a theoretical measure. Remember, I told you we might have these problems where we just can't measure big enough. And something different happens when we have a really big size. And let's think of a really, really huge n, like n equals 2 to the 10,000. So if that's n, if we want to store the size of this vector, we need a 1,000 plus bit number. And it seems like, gosh, that has to be slower than when we have a 64-bit number to store the size. And you're right, it would have to be slower. We're doing more stuff, and if we make n even bigger, if we make n 2 to the 100,000, it has to get slower than that. So usually we're going to make this assumption, which is a, you know, perhaps a very unrealistic assumption, but it's going to make our analysis much easier. And that's going to be that we're going to say any normal integer arithmetic, think intuitively the kind of stuff you just store in an int or a long, we're going to assume that that's constant time. Even if for some really, really galactically huge sizes, that wouldn't be the case. So there is asymptotic analysis which takes this sort of issue into account and doesn't make this assumption that when we have things like sizes, that's going to be constant time, that we're going to have something like a long and it's always going to take the same amount of time to like add them together. But it's not particularly common because usually we actually only care about things where we have some native arithmetic size which handles all the normal arithmetic we need to do. But there's some, for example, bit complexity is a thing you might hear about where instead of measuring the number of like integer arithmetic operations, we measure the number of bit operations. This gets very tedious, which is the main reason we don't do it, because you need to think about things like, oh, you're multiplying? Well, how long does multiplying take? Does anyone know what the time complexity of multiplication is? And well, of course you wouldn't. It doesn't really come up very often, especially since our hardware like does it for a 64-bit integer in essentially constant time, because, well, it's 64 bits. Just has that hardwired. But when you want to do it with bigger integers, well, there's multiple choices, and you need to figure out which one we're using, and the runtimes are inconvenient things like n to the 1.5, 3 something. So we just don't deal with that complexity because we typically only care about sizes where, yeah, the size could get big, but you know, practically speaking, it's not going to be, say, bigger than 64 bits, or at least not bigger than 128 bits. So we don't want to care about these integer operations and how long they take. So any questions about this assumption or constant time? So another next big class is logarithmic time. So the classic example is binary search of a sorted array, where we cut the search space in half each iteration. So we get a ceiling of log base 2 of n iterations maximum, which you can think of that we have 2 to the k iterations, searches n elements. That's how that log naturally comes about. Another example is when we have a balanced search tree. When we do search and insert, so we do our binary search tree algorithms, and we somehow know the tree is balanced. So this means that there's a guarantee that the height, that's the distance from the root where we start to any element, is bounded by log n. I say theta of log n, so it could be the minimum possible height, or it could be a little worse than that, but it's not asymptotically worse. Then we have logarithmic time. Okay. So our next very important class, which comes up all the time, is linear time. And the intuition is that we have a bunch of elements, and we do some constant number of operations per element. And again, this is asymptotic, so you can think of it so that there's a maximum number of operations we do per element, and that's what we're bounding things by. So classic examples include printing a list, searching an unsorted array, or a linked list, even if the linked list is sorted, because you can't exactly go to the middle of a linked list very fast. Doubling the size of a vector, because we need to copy the n elements in the vector to do that. And we're thinking about allocating a new array and copying to it. And when we have a binary search tree that's not balanced, this is the time for a find and or insert. And the way you can prove that to yourself is that, well, what does the worst possible binary search tree look like? Well, it's a linked list. We have a left and right child, and we only use the left or the right one every time. And in fact, you can make that happen by just choosing the right things to insert and remove and find. You can just make that always be the case that you have a binary search tree that looks like that with sort of naive way of managing it. And so that means that it's linear time because we care about the worst case. Yes, that doesn't happen naturally, but you need to have some more formal restriction than when we don't get unlucky to in order to say that it's not linear time. So any questions about these? Yes?
Why does the doubling the size of the vector?
The question is, why is doubling the size of the vector linear time? We copy theta and bytes to new array. Yes, so we make this new array of double the size, and we copy, in the worst case, theta and bytes. Maybe sometimes we're able to allocate the new array in the same place and not need to copy, in which case it's constant time, but not always. Other questions? So our next big class is perhaps the first not really intuitive one, which is log linear. This is theta of n times log of n. As I said, the classic example is something like fast comparison-based sorting. So I'm actually not sure what sorting algorithms you've seen before. So have you seen merge sort, heap sort, quick sort? Good, okay, so you know all of these, good. So merge sort and heap sort, they're n log n. There are examples where they have this property that, you know, it's kind of like you're doing a binary search for each element as far as what the runtime is. Because n log n is the same as log n n times, which is what the time for a binary search in a sort of list is. So it's kind of similar to that. So merge sort and heap sort are n log n. Quick sort is a strange case. So if you have the right pivot choices, it doesn't need to be like the optimal pivot choices, it just needs to be good pivot choices, then quick sort can be n log n. If you have some unlucky pivot choices, then quick sort is quadratic. And sort of the unlucky pivot choices you can think of are, let's say we choose a pivot at random and every time we choose the lowest possible thing in our remaining list. In that case, what your quick sort is doing is you're extracting the lowest possible item, then putting all the others in a list. And then you're doing that for every item, so you're doing some amount of work that's about the same as the size of the array for each element of the array, so it's n squared. But when we have good pivot choices, we're basically splitting the array in half each time, so we have that sort of 2 to the k equals n, solve for n, get log n iterations for and n elements to go through in total that number of times. Similarly, when we talk about balanced binary search trees, all the operation, doing n operations on them will generally have the same amount of time, which is sort of a nice equivalence between binary search tree time and sort of sorted array times. So if inserting n elements into a binary search tree takes the same amount of time asymptotically as sorting an array, well, they're both as efficient ways to sort a bunch of values as each other. So any questions on any of these? Intuition for log linear time? Okay. So our next big class is quadratic. So this includes slow comparison-based sorting. So insertion sort, bubble sort, selection sort, all those sorting algorithms where you're doing something which ends up being about as bad as take every element, look at every other element. Maybe it's a little bit better, but sort of in the worst case, it's about that bad. And quick sort, as I mentioned, if we have these bad pivot choices, where we're basically splitting the array up into one element and everything else for each time. And anything where you want to write a doubly nested for loop where both loops go up to n. So our next big class is exponential. And the way you should think about it is we have an n-bit solution, and we just try all of the possibilities. Any problem where you have an n-bit solution, you can just try everything and do it. And this means that you can basically solve everything. So for example, if you have a combination lock and you want to just try every possibility, that's like this, because we're just writing down every possible answer. It takes n bits to do that. We're trying all of them. Another example is if you know the board game Go, if you want to find the best move, you can do that in exponential time. And in fact, there's a proof, which is why I mentioned it as an example, even though it's a pretty complicated problem. There's a proof that that's the best you can do, which is not at all intuitive. And there's nothing better than that for finding the best possible move in generalized Go. I have these other examples where I have this big asterisk because, well, as far as we know, if I have a Boolean expression, so I have something with ands and ors and a bunch of variables, x and y and z, and it's of length n, as far as we know, the best algorithm for doing this is not asymptotically better, much better than trying all the possibilities. But we don't actually have a proof that that's the case, so it might be the case there's something which is not exponential which solves that. This is the p equals np issue. And similarly, another example we'll come up with later, which is the traveling salesman problem. Have you seen traveling salesman? Okay, so some of you have. That's another example of something where the best known algorithms are exponential, but we don't actually have a proof that that's the case. But the example of the Go game, we actually have a proof that you can't do better than exponential. So these are common complexity classes, and there are more complexity classes you might come across naturally. So one example is I mentioned cubic, so that does come up in reality. So if I have, so who seen graphs, or do I need to describe what a graph is? Okay, only a couple people. So if I have, say, a road network, and I want to find, so I have like a bunch of roads, I know the distances on the roads, I want to find all the shortest paths between every pair of items, every pair of locations. So I have n locations, and I want to find all the n squared shortest paths and how far it is to get between all of them. There's an algorithm to do that in n cubed time. And you can think of that what's happening internally is that for every item, for every location, for every other location, we do something for every other location. So we have a triply nested loop, so that ends up being n squared, n cubed. There are also things which are kind of in between. So for example, the best known integer factorization algorithm is this funny complexity class, this funny complexity. It's about 2 to the n to the 1/3. So it's not 2 to the n, it's way better than trying every possible like set of bits. Way, way better than that, but it's way, way worse than anything polynomial. So any questions on Big O? Not will. Okay, so I will briefly start preview our next topic in the last 5 minutes. So next, we're going to talk a bit about trees. And we're specifically going to go into, mostly talk about balanced trees. And these are interesting because, they have nice big O's. Those are the examples where we got big O of n log n or log n for operations, which was better than we could do with anything but sorted arrays. But we need to deal with some extra details you haven't seen before. So you've seen binary search trees before, and binary search trees before are kind of hope we don't get unlucky, and we'll have nice efficient operations. So here we're going to get rid of that hope we get don't get unlucky part, and we're going to somehow manage to keep things so that we're in that lucky state where things are pretty efficient. So there are other applications of trees, which we'll briefly mention. And I guess one intuition for this is that, everything we're doing with trees, or later on with graphs, which are basically a generalization of trees, are things we could just do with lists. Like everything you do with a binary search tree, you can do with a list. But we're going to get sort of two big benefits out of having this different representation. So one is that we're going to organize our items so we can more efficiently access them. We want better than linear time to find something, and we don't want to just have to choose our list of items, then sort it, and sort it by each thing we want to search by in advance. We want to be able to have things be added and removed and have that be maintained efficiently, which we can't really do with a sorted array. And we also sometimes want to represent relationships more naturally. So when we have a tree, you can think of that every item in the tree, it's related to, in a binary tree, to potentially a parent and to children. And if that's meaningful for your problem, that might be more natural than a list where you have a separate list of how are things related in some way. Yes?
Is tree another type of abstract data structure?
So the question is a tree another type of abstract data type? And you could think of it that way. We'll generally be not looking at it in that sense. We'll be looking at it more as a way of implementing other types of abstract data types. And you can think of trees as a kind of generalization of lists. So I mentioned that the worst case for a linked list, searching a linked list, a binary search tree was the same as a linked list. And this is because you can say, a linked list is just a binary search tree where we got really unlucky. They're exactly the same thing, we just have this extra pointer we're not using. So a linked list is just this diminutive sort of binary search tree where it's a unary search tree. And we don't have any ordering. And so when we have a binary tree, we just have more than just a predecessor and successor we're related to. And we're representing more relationships that we say that, now each node, can have a bunch of children and maybe a parent. It has a whole bunch of things it can be related to. And if those are meaningful for our problem, it's easier to find the related things. And you can think of a binary search tree as a special case of this, where the related things are things which are greater or less because we want to find things that are related by order. The relationships are telling us something about the order relative to other items. Okay. So you can think of trees as letting us represent more relationships. With a linked list, our relationship was next or previous. With a tree, it's greater than, less than for a binary search tree. And we could think of other things we want to represent. But we're not going to allow just arbitrary relationships. We're going to have this big and very important restriction. And that's that we're going to have this root. We're going to have a place where we start. And there's going to be a single way to get to the root to everything. So in a binary search tree, the root sort of divided our tree in half. And each time, we divided the space in half again. So we ended up not having only one way to get to everything. So this gives us our classic structure. And to give an example of the sort of thing we might imagine being represented, which is not what we've seen with a binary search tree, here is a phylogenetic tree, a tree of relationships of animals and plants. You know, we're saying they're related to each other, so there's a common ancestor, common global class, and these different plants are related in some way, and we've got this tree of different kinds of life forms. That's a sort of naturally occurring tree, and just like our binary search tree, when we want to find something that's related to something else, this tree is going to help us do that better than just a big list of items, even though we could still do all the same, let's find the things which are in the same class on that list of items. And we'll talk about that again next time after the midterm.